The Black Widow spiders were king size, and there were other poisonous creatures too. We struggled up the steep slope of our shaped mountain for a day and a half. The trail became so precarious at times that Leigh and I actually took time out hanging up there, and wrote up an agreement. If either one of us were bitten and died, or one went over one of the impossible precipices and was killed, the other would not try to get the body out for fear of being lost too, but would go out and report the event for others to worry about. Our body weight alone was enough of starter derump, a landslide, once that went down thousands of feet and left an exposed scar on the side of the mountain that would be seen for years. Leigh crashed right through a mammoth spider web that stuck all over him. I chidingly said the owner of the web looked like a black widow. He didn't even look for her, just slung a leg over a shrub growing out of the steep earth to keep from sliding when he let go with his hands and said, "Look over there." I did and saw a kind of dead fowl, bloated and purplish. One of the Indians said, "Wilbur, snake." It made me shudder to think they were all around us and we couldn't see them. We got to within a couple hundred feet of the top and started to move sidewise to come upon the temple structure near the dome, only to find that a derump had carried away everything down to sheer rock. We were dead tired and heartbroken. We had to go back down and go another way. When we finally got to the base of the temple, we found a level stone path, narrow but solid, that led right past the bottom tier of stone. The Indians ahead of us had loosened the half-circle ceiling stone, revealing a tall skeleton of a human being, a round agate, and a red stone cylinder seal, like the ones used by the ancient Assyrian kings and the early Egyptian pharaohs to delegate authority. What it was doing here was a great mystery. We had, however, seen other ancient Assyrian and pre-Babylonian artifacts that had been taken from the caves of Port not far from here. But an even bigger mystery to us was the tomb cavity. It was of a clean creamy white stone that showed no chisel or excavation marks, and could not have been smoothed. The surface was of a smooth rock matrix with small crystals of quartz embedded in it. I looked like a part of the native rock face at that place, but the embedded quartz crystals were not broken or damaged as one would expect if the surface had been smoothed by abrasion. A small corner chipped out for study showed a surface that indicated rock matrix material cleanly evacuated from around the crystals, like it had been done with sonic waves like a dentist uses to clean teeth, or possibly other disintegrating frequencies. A strange surface. When a flash was directed inside, the tiny quartz crystals looked like diamonds flashing in the dark. We were unable to scale the steep face of the temple structure to get to the dome on top without climbing gear, which we did not bring. We wondered about that dome because no known civilization in South America was known to set a keystone in order to make an arch or dome. It was here that we first heard of the abandoned and overgrown ruins of a great city in the jungle to the south. It was not too far from where we were, as the crow flies. But it took weeks to get to it on the ground because we had to go back over the Andes and down to Guayaquil sea level, to start out again lower down, through different passes and lower jungles. But there again we encountered a similar stone half-sphere, and this one too was the size of a small house. This one, however, was completely covered with strange symbols and stick figures of beings and animals doing different things. It was at the river gateway to the city mentioned in the preface to this edition, and seemed to be particularly prominent. An interesting thing still to be investigated is what was under that huge stone dome. Antonio Vintimilla, a cousin of Adriamo, a dentist in another town called Santa Rosa on the west side of the Andes, treated an Indian boy with a terribly infected tooth and let him go back to his tribe. While he was in the dentist chair, he noticed that the dentist had several pre-Columbian stone heads on the shelf in front of the window. A few weeks later, now well again, that Indian boy showed up with several more to put on the shelf as gifts. Intrigued, the dentist sent for an interpreter and asked where they came from. The boy described the lost city, and ultimately guided Antonio there. The Indians found a hole under the base of the great round stone, a small round hole like an animal warren, and they cut a pole about 5 feet long to try to poke the animal out. The pole went all the way into the hole and fell out of reach. They cut another longer one about 12 feet long and tried again. The same thing happened. They put several more longer poles in the same hole and they all disappeared. We have concluded that there may be a room under that dome, but lacking digging tools and also permission, that project had to be given up for a later time. The later time never came as we never went back to that difficult place. The Indians do not want to be disturbed, and we prefer to leave it that way. It is their property, not ours. We value their friendship to this day. There was also another feature there which may have been a vertical landing place in that city, 200 foot diameter circular platforms, and three of them in a cluster, just like the three circular pads used by the Iribians at their plantations. The natives in this vicinity all reported familiarity with the Brothers from the Sky, as they call them. There they are not as mysterious as the jet transports that pass overhead and never land. Did somebody in earlier times the know technologies still unknown to us? There is a great deal of mystery here. An interesting commentary may be offered here on relative civilizations. It is important to note the difference in concepts of what is called civilization and by whom. Some civilizations possess a good many thousands of years of maturity, and some like ours enjoy only a few hundred, and it is ours which seeks to destroy all others, no matter how innocent, and ours too in one mighty holocaust initiated by our own society. The Indian boy from near the lost city had his own idea. That Jivaro boy, whom we shall call Luis, was impressed by some of the things he saw when he came out of his Javeria in 1971 and later. After we left his country in 1972, he contacted a missionary and attended a literacy school where we learned to read and write enough in Spanish to get by. He worked and prepared constantly for our promised return when we would document that unknown city properly for his tribe and for history. We had promised not to compromise his Javeria by revealing its location, and we kept our promise. He had promised to look for something in the city for us, and he kept his promise. One thing that can be depended on down there is the word of a Jivaro, but if you cross him you are in great danger. We had tried to put together a team to study the city without having to reveal its exact location, a commitment we intended to keep, because we were well aware of what the local government could and would probably do under the circumstances. There was plenty of precedent in the history of the country. A denuncia would be filed, claiming all sovereignty over the land for the state, and the Indians would then be driven off or put on a reservation by the state and the state would take over the Javeria as a federal property. Hundreds of our friends would lose their homes in the process. We had promised not to let that happen. We had been unable to put together any project in all this time that would guarantee the promise we had made, and so we were still home in Arizona when an unbelievable event happened. 8 years after we left that forgotten city, in 1980, Lay Elders, the leader of our expedition there at that time, received a collect telephone call from California. It had been placed from a mestizo speaking poor English for another man who was waiting. They were calling from the U.S. Immigration Detention Center on the U.S. and Mexican border near San Diego, a prison, where an undocumented alien speaking poor Spanish and no English, had come to understand that he could make one telephone call. With help from some Mexicans whom he was able to make understand that he had a friend up here, Lay Elders in Arizona. They obtained a number from directory service and the call was finally put through to Lee. We were flabbergasted and amazed to discover that the Jivaro boy, now Luis the man, had continued with the project we had left him, had found what we wanted him to look for, and thinking we must be having some problems up here in getting back there, had come out of his home Javeria, sold some things to raise a little money, had obtained an identity certificate, so he could journey across the local borders of his country, and having little knowledge of world expenses or travel, and a history book map of the Western Hemisphere, had made his way all through Central America and Mexico and to the United States to help us get back to the city. After coming all that distance the hard way and finally arriving at the U.S. border, and having learned something about borders by now, he stopped two Mexican policemen in Mexicali and asked about procedures to cross into the United States. The policeman asked him how much money he had and Luis showed him. The policeman took it all and then took him to a hole in the fence and pointed him through and left. Luis thought this strange, but after all the officer was an authority and who would question that? Luis marched through and headed right for the town to make contact with somebody. The first man he stopped was a border patrol officer who wanted to see his papers. When he found only an identification certificate, in Spanish, with no passport, no visas, no money and no relatives here, he put Luis on a bus and took him right to prison in the detention center. There he was frisked, all of his remaining few possessions were taken away from him, including his small change and his identification certificate which he had been told never to let out of his possession. He thought these North American police were really a greedy bunch, even worse than the bandits farther south, and here they worked in shifts, one after another. They were much worse than the civilized police in his own country. They mistreated him, photographed and fingerprinted him, and locked him in a cell. He wondered why. He wondered what they were going to charge him with. How would he ever find the friends he came to help? Maybe they were locked up in this strange society too? Everybody he saw seemed to be locked up. Nobody seemed to be interested in him at all after locking him up. Finally, he met somebody in the exercise yard with whom he could communicate, and was able to explain enough that together they set out to find and make contact with Lee, losing almost a month in the process. Several times border authorities tried to send him back to Mexico, but he couldn't accept that. He would only go to the Mexican police who he now knew were just as bad. And finally his luck turned. Lee answered his phone and accepted the collect call from a name he did not recognize, and Luis was put on the line. He recognized Lee's voice and Lee's instantly, and was so overwhelmed by all he had been through that he broke down and silently sobbed. He had survived a lot of adversity, overcoming trials. Here he was, the son of a great chief, of a large independent Chivaria, would someday be the chief himself, and may now be, a real aristocrat in his own society, having traveled halfway around the world, in a difficult and extensive journey, locked in prison for a crime he did not understand, in a strange country full of thieving barbarians who robbed him of all he owned, where he was trying to bring the news to his friends and help them get back to finish the project from so many years ago. Lee hung up the phone, grabbed a change of clothes and his shaving kit and got his car and drove the 450 miles without a rest stop to do what he could for Luis. Our rules are tough. He was unable to do any more than get another week's delay in deportation by posting a bond, but he was able to get Luis sent back to his own country by paying the difference in the ticket. Luis will never forget the uncivilized barbarians he met up here after leaving the safety of his home Javeria. And we will never break our promise to respect the security of his society by revealing the true location of the abandoned city. If we can introduce Luis to the extraterrestrial plantations in return for showing Mr. Palman the city, the secrecy of both may be mutually secured by the other. No other condition is open to consideration. The end. Many thanks to David Walsh in England for processing this, so that people can get access to this important information.